our next guests are probably responsible for more babies than Sunnybrook Hospital. Well, not independently or even together. But in 2003, with little fanfare, one of them founded a dating site in his apartment. He hopes by doing so would display enough of his skills at ASP.net to land him a job somewhere. 12 years later, July 14th, 2015, the dating site Plenty of Fish was sold for $575 million to the Match Group. These are the Match.com people, OkCupid, Tinder. A few years beforehand, our other guest sold his own dating site, Lavalife, to First Media Group. Please welcome Lavalife co-founder, former Dragon, co-host of BNN's The Disruptors and Round 13 Capital Boss, Bruce Croxon, and Plenty of Fish founder, Mark Frin. Gentlemen, come on up. At some point, we're probably going to be doing a Q&A as well, and I'll grab a microphone and do the old Phil Donahue routine if you've got any questions.
Perfect. Well, a bit ironic that we're sitting here together because we used to have a picture of you up in our boardroom with a dartboard you used to throw darts at. Because this really is a story about, you know, we thought we were disrupting a dating market and this guy came along and disrupted us. But before we talk dating, or whenever I do anyway, I like to ask the audience, just so I know, you know, who we're talking with, if anyone in the audience, who hasn't heard of either Lavalife or Plenty of Fish being Canadian dating sites? So everyone's heard of the sites, that's good to know, because I think we both did a good job of getting our brand out there. Who's used the service? Either one? See, a good chunk of this room is full of shit, because it's a data-driven business, so we know. They're lying, we know. But this was a problem I think both of us had, and certainly Lavalife had in the beginning, was, you know, getting by the stigma that if you're using technology to get a date, it might mean you couldn't get a date any other way. So I'm just going to set the stage a little bit before I ask Marcus some questions, because he's kind of the hero of the space. Remarkable story, and one that hasn't been told too often, largely because he's a pretty private guy. So thanks for coming, first of all. Thanks to Cantech for having both of us on the stage at the same time. The year was 2003. Lavalife had been up and running as a website, monetizing for at least 4 years. I think we branded our phone service and our web service as Lavalife in and around 2000. And times were very good for us. I mean, we disrupted an industry. Lavalife was arguably leading the world as one of the first social networks in the world. And we were making lots of money, largely by charging people for men and women's, most of this room obviously accepted, men and women's most basic human need, which after food and a roof over your head, you're looking for a companion. So we were both in the same space. Lavalife was doing great. And then this kid at the time, really, popped up from northern BC, down to small town northern BC, down in Vancouver. We heard rumors about this guy in his apartment with one or two servers that had the audacity to offer for free what the rest of us were charging good, healthy money for. We're pissed. How did you get into it? Tell us a little bit about what drew you to the dating world. And one of my partners was a serial dater. That's how we got into it. So we were doing what came naturally. But what attracted you to the space?
So back in 2003, or 2001 even, it was the end of the dot-com boom. I was jumping from job to job and I needed to improve my resume and learn ASP.net. So I bought the domain in 2001, basically didn't do anything for 2 years. Then in 2003, I was jumping from job to job again. I was like, I really should sit down and learn this new programming language. So basically I spent 2 weeks and built Plenty of Fish. And then I threw it live on my home computer running off TELUS within a few weeks, all of a sudden it started ranking in search engine. All these people started coming and signing up, and it started blowing up. And I really didn't do anything. I just had it running on my home internet.
You were still alone at the time, right? You were working by yourself.
Oh yeah,
just you and a bunch of computers. Tonight we had a staff at that time, probably of around 400 people. The computers taking up 3/4 of this room, and your...
I was just more efficient.
Yeah, exactly. Something not quite fair about that. But anyway, so you start out with a couple of servers, buy the domain, put it... Where did you find it?
I didn't buy a single server. What I did is I just ran off my home machine. It was just my computer, and I installed the internet web server software, and I was running off my home internet connection for the first year and a half. And then it got so much traffic, I was like, you can't serve the website, so I was like, I'll spend $500 and go buy a server. And then bought some hosting space and threw it in there, and it just started growing. Like every week you'd see 2-5% growth, and you just like, oh my god, I need some new hardware, I need some this, you just
so when you first sort of got on our radar, we were hearing $10 million in revenue, 2-4 servers in your apartment. Do I have it about right? Was that?
It's about right.
About right.
The servers weren't in the apartment at that time because of the bandwidth.
You had to incur some office overhead.
Yeah, I had like 2 billion pages a month off a single web server and one database server.
So you had to get out. Your apartment couldn't handle it.
Yeah, the outbound traffic was easy. Bandwidth for hosting bills is like in the thousands of dollars a month.
So, and I'll actually bring you back to that time too, because it's something we take for granted now as a way to monetize internet companies is the Google AdWords down the side. But you were early in that. I mean, you were one of the first to say, well, I don't have to really charge the customer. If I get enough people with a focused enough interest, then I think the Google AdWords might be as good or better way to monetize.
Yeah, it was Google AdSense. AdWords is the other side.
AdSense.
And I signed up the day it came out, and I think it was June 2003. It was in beta in March of 2003. So it was immediately after I launched, but I was also running affiliate programs. There's a whole bunch of different ways of making money.
You would have been one of Google's best customers out of the gate, I got to assume.
I know.
With that amount of traffic.
Well, the traffic came later, so the $1 million check, was in 2007, so... that was for 2 months earnings, I made $1 million. And the expenses were non-existent.
So what stage in your development did you decide, maybe I better go hire a few people? now you're still only 75 people, generating about $90 million, right? So
it was back in...
That's cash flow, by the way.
That was in 2008, I remember it was the end of March, and I was sitting around, and I was like, I really should. I was thinking of getting a lease, and I was looking at moving to a different apartment. My first apartment I bought, and at the same time, I was getting acquisition offers in the hundreds of millions of dollars, and VCs coming. So I was like, I'm traveling 2-3 months of the year, and have this business kind of building on the side, and there's all these people that want to either buy the company or invest in it or whatnot. Maybe I should really turn this into a full-time business and learn how to actually manage and run a company. Because up until that time, I'd been just working out of my apartment for 5 years. Just basically whenever I felt like getting up, going, typing on the computer, and then doing whatever.
Unbelievable. So when you got all those approaches out of the blue, as people started to see the ranking and that kind of thing, did you shut the interest down right away, or did you entertain anybody investing in the company, or where was your head at it?
Pretty much, I wouldn't even answer the emails or talk to most of the people after. Talking to the first one or two, was interesting. It's like, oh my god, there's just like a flood. I remember one day there was like 7 calls before noon, and my phone number was not public and email. Like, just how
they
do people find me?
Yeah.
And it was after the Today Show. Like, I did an interview on the Today Show and the Wall Street Journal. And overnight, my traffic increased about 27%, and it just permanently stayed there and kept on climbing.
So why do I need money?
Exactly. And when you have millions in the bank and you have no expenses, and it's just dating sites are basically printing presses for cash.
It's a little ironic that we're having this conversation at this conference where 90% of the audience is geared to help young companies monetize and thereby sharing the spoils themselves. And Lab Life was certainly that story. A lot of people did well off of Lab Life, but I got to highlight, and we'll talk about the road to a sale and Marcus's experience. I don't know too many. I've met a lot of entrepreneurs moving in the circles that I have. I don't know anybody. I haven't met anybody that had an $800 million Canadian exit, single shareholder, 75 employees. I mean, I know they're out there somewhere, but I just haven't come across many of them. unbelievable Canadian success story that not a ton of people know about, which is, you know, why I'm happy to have gotten you out of the apartment into the Toronto Convention Center. So road to a sale. I noticed one thing in 2013, and I actually didn't notice this till I went back and started doing a little homework on you. In 2013, because Plenty of Fish had been this, you know, especially at the beginning, it was a largely unstructured place. Like, you come in, put your profile up, do what you want, right? I mean, we're not here to tell people how to date or what their proclivity, judging their proclivities. In 2013, you put in a policy where if you were a certain age as a male, you couldn't reach out to females below a certain age, which I found pretty interesting. You also did away with the intimate encounter section. So you were, for want of a better term, you were cleaning things up. Were you thinking that about a sale at that time, or is this some change that was going on in your life? Or
well, that was more, I wanted to, the problem with dating is there's nothing adjacent to expand into. So you generate tons and tons of cash flow, but you have nothing to buy and you have nothing to move into. So your only two options are, how can I grow and expand this into a broader market, or how can I buy something that's semi-adjacent and maybe it'll work. So really a lot of those changes I was testing to see if I could dramatically double or triple the size of the user base by trying to appeal to more people. So this, you know, it's fringe behavior. It was 1% of people would, you know, men would go message 18-year-olds and they would get pissed off and leave. So it was really increase the lifetime value of users and increase the length of time they stay on site.
Okay, so there was a rationale to every move you made.
Yeah, I mean, you every single thing that is done within the company is split tested. There is no, like, anytime you make a decision, I think, I feel, I believe, you're going to screw something up.
Right, just data driven.
Yeah.
That's how we know that 3/4 of this room have been on either one of the two sites, right? It's a data driven.
If you do not do that, you will be out of business. If you look on Angel's List, there's over 1,000 dating sites. I think there's 3 or 4 on that list that actually make any money.
Right.
The rest are out of business.
No, well, largely,
most
of them. A lot of them out of business because you came along and said, why do we have to charge for this? Let's give it for free, right? I mean, fairness, you disrupted the whole
But we
have
charging as well, you know, we just did it.
I saw that, and then you can get a premium. You were the first premium, really, in the dating space, I'd have to say.
Give it away
for free and then start to charge. So Match.com comes knocking on the apartment door. You entertained that discussion, whereas, you know, every year since you started, you were hard to find. What was it that was different about this? Was it a timing thing? What led you to want to monetize?
Well, basically, you know, I've been doing this since 2003. These companies come knocking every single door. You talk about, at the end of the day, you know, 14 years or 13 years, whatever it is a very long time. And I just thought, you know, it just gets boring. If you look at what the site is today and you look at it was 5 years, it was pretty much the same thing. There's 5 core features. There's 5 pages you make all your money on. And there's the algorithms and the things behind them. So because it is an industry where you can't expand into other businesses or adjacent categories, you're really only stuck optimizing, making small tweaks here that all of a sudden add up to large changes. But that gets really boring after a while, and I was like, you know, this is enough.
So you just had enough, you'd run out of energy.
Yeah, it just gets really tiring after a while, and, you know, it's great to print its cash, but.
So what was the deal process like from start to finish? They reached out, you said, okay, what do you have in mind? They were in the process of spinning out of IAC to go public, right? So it was in many ways perfect timing. This was a great part of the story for them.
Yeah. we just had to go through full US GAAP within the span of a month and a half. So we had to get from just preparing financial statements for tax purposes to doing a full audit in US GAAP is interesting. And for an IPO. So the due diligence process after the LOI, it took a span of 2 weeks.
That was
all
it?
Done in 2 weeks.
Okay.
So that was
a result of how organized you were or how badly they wanted to buy your company?
We were really well organized, and they've done a ton of acquisitions, right? So it's they knew exactly what to do. They had a large deal team. So you ask for the right data, and you know exactly how the business is performing.
And when the check got put in the bank, $800 million.
Well, that was a good
single shareholder.
But it took four or five months to clear, because we had to go through antitrust in multiple countries and then the regulatory approvals to get that deal.
So when did it finally close?
Closed at the end of October.
Do you remember how you felt that day? I mean,
relief.
Halloween.
Relief. It's more relief. It's finally done.
Yeah.
Because there's just so much stuff going on all the time. It's like, thank God this is over.
So end of October, we're talking now, it's February. What's life been like for you? I know you tell me you've taken some time off and are thinking about, you know, what's next.
Yeah.
But I also know you've done some direct deals, which I want to talk to, because this is a country where we don't have a ton of these stories. And, you know, we're now starting to experience second and third time entrepreneurs in the IT space. And we're doing our best to put that money back in, mentor the next generation of entrepreneurs, because I think you feel this way, I certainly feel this way. You know, Canadian tech entrepreneurs for sure can hold their own with anyone in the world. We need a little bit more capital at play, and we sell short a lot, but if given the right support, I think we can hold our own with anyone in the world, and here's living proof right here. So what have you been doing since? This is a bit of an irony too, from a guy that we used to have his page, his face up in our boardroom with a dartboard. He's backed us at Round 13 Capital to try and invest in the next stage of tech companies. So from being sort of mortal rivals to, yeah, we're not friends yet, but we know each other and support, mutual support, I think is kind of cool. And we're both focused on getting the Canadian tech sector where it needs to be on a global scale. So what have you been doing? I know Cymax is one that you're really proud of, that you've gone direct in. Tell us a little bit about Cymax. When you picked them up, when they got on your radar, what where they're at now, and why you're so excited about it. I know we're gonna have a presentation from the founder later. Right?
Yeah. So as part of building POF, I wrote every line of code, I did absolutely everything. I grew it into the largest data set in the world before I hired a single employee. So we had over 15 million users and over 10 million of revenues. So through that experience, I gained a tremendous amount of knowledge that you simply wouldn't get anywhere else. And so when I saw Cymax, I met the CEO at a tech CEO dinner in Vancouver, and he was looking at raising money. And once I started digging into the business, I was just surprised at how similar it was to dating. You know, there's a search page, there's a product profile page, and there's some kind of checkout process. And the whole
business is built on how much does it cost to get a customer.
Exactly.
And the difference between what that customer is worth, and that's called a gross margin when and if you
yeah. So it's a whole life cycle marketing, the whole funnel thing.
Yep, very similar.
It's all the same thing.
Yep.
And you know, typically I don't like e-commerce because e-commerce is like, you know, piling your money together and then lighting it on fire. But Wayfair is one of their competitors, and it's the only e-commerce company that is valued over $1 billion. And Rocket Internet, which clones everything under the sun, the only e-commerce play they want to clone is furniture. So furniture is this one industry that is, you know, it's $200-300 billion, and dating is $2 billion. I mean, it's just 100 times bigger. And what I really liked about them is when I looked into it, you know, they can do $1 billion in online sales. They can do $1 billion gross merchandise value on their logistics business. And I thought they could do $1 billion on their kind of Shopify clone for furniture stores. And I very rarely run into businesses where you have such a market, the opportunity is so vast.
Right.
And to execute on it's not terribly difficult.
Right.
Especially when you're already there, right?
From where you've come from, yeah.
So I like to invest in businesses like that, and then I also like to have like deep access into the business. Like I get database access, I can look at the reports, I can suggest changes and see things. Because what I learned at POF was the biggest changes ever to revenue were things that took 5-10 minutes to implement.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't like these projects that you spent 6 months working on. They never. Sometimes it led to something, but rarely. It was always like tweak. You know, instead of saying on your checkout page, you would change instead of most popular, best deal to most popular, 5% increase in revenues. Like, those are the kind of things that you're looking for, and those are the kind of things that a drive tremendous amount of value.
Yeah, and I'll put my pitch in. You know, Ruffalo talked earlier about switching from a resource-based economy to a tech innovation economy. I mean, all the tools are there. I mean, we've got the entrepreneurs that are now coming out of some of them two and three exits. They've been healthy. We're entering an age that I would argue is the most profound period of change since actual since the internet started to get commercialized, which is really just the ability to put an IP address on every piece of material on the planet and the data that generates, and people like you that have the brains to measure what behavior is in relation to those objects and then do the right things back using technology, getting the feedback right away, putting it back out. I mean, it's really changing the world. I mean, my father talks about, you know, he's 87, talks about his most profound period of change being jet engines and, you know, how quickly we can move from A to B. I don't think we'll ever see anything like the mid-90s when, you know, this band sort of it called the internet brought the world together in a commercial way. But I would argue we're in, you know, the second most profound period for me, which is really linked to the amount of data that's being generated. It's exponential. And how good life's getting for consumers as a result.
So there's a whole bunch of business model innovation that you can do. And just look at your business versus mine, right? Like, I was sitting in my apartment, one guy, and I built a bigger site than you had with
exactly.
200 employees.
Yep.
Like,
and thank you for that. I would have said that if you hadn't, right? But it's absolutely true, because, you know, we talk about a lot in technology today, and for those entrepreneurs in the crowd that are in the tech business or people that are looking to invest in it, it is not a technology barrier to entry anymore. You know, despite John Ruffalo's comments about the importance of IP and how important it is important, but it is not the barrier to entry anywhere near that it was when I started out and then, you know, when you came along. And I have to give you credit, because, you know, what is commonplace today that, you know, an entrepreneur that's good at code can see an idea and put it up in his apartment 2 weeks Saturday and disrupt an industry, you did back in 2003. So, you know, it's a heck of a story. I'm really glad that you consented to come and tell it, because it hasn't been told enough. You're a very private person, I know that, I knew that from the beginning. When I asked you to come, you know, it was, boy, I'm making money, why do I need to come and talk about it? So I had to talk you into it a little bit. I appreciate it. And I find it fascinating. I think more people should know it. So thanks, and I'd like to thank you. And we saved about 5 minutes if there's any questions from the audience, and then we'll wrap. There's one about four rows back on the left, Mike, and then
we're gonna start back here. If you were to start your business over again with things like AWS, would you start it from your computer and move to 3-4 servers versus today maybe just going straight to AWS and other options? What would you do if you were to start POF today?
In dating, technology is not a cost. It's marketing. So unless you have a $20 or $30 million marketing budget, you're not getting anywhere. So it's all about how can you get to critical mass? And technology just does not matter in that case.
You know, it's an interesting contrast between a one dude and a team. And how much, so I want to get into
one smart dude.
Well, yeah, specifically smart, but what's interesting is that people talk about big data all day long, but it's really the analytics, it's the ability to have deep insight. And, you know, sometimes there's a team problem because as a collective they don't work as well as some one smart dude A/B testing one word and seeing that there's a 5% pickup. So how much, you know, for example, we wanted to invest in Simax, you beat us to it, but good for you. But you know, one of the things that's interesting is that with these simple teams or individuals, the insight many times is much more poignant. And I'm wondering how much of that is what's going to affect the big data, because the big data is just a real big pile of poo if you don't have any insight into that. And I think that's one of the big issues. There's all this name drop big data all over the place. It's now the big hot word. But from your perspective, and your perspective, how does a team get as smart as a single individual? Because if we only rely on, because guys like you might have been in his team, but they might have been silenced. And so I'm more interested in understanding how can teams be better put together so they get more insightful, so that better insights can come from some of these types of guys.
Yeah, so most people think that big data is just writing a bunch of reports, but the only way that it is useful is if you have a report and you take some action upon it. Like, if you do something and it moves some a number on your financial statement, otherwise it doesn't matter, it's just a report. And it's really about structuring and process within the organization. So how do you set your goals? How do you, it's really process driven. It's not, data is data.
So from a guy that has always had business partners and, you know, really has been about, I put a lot of energy into defining what the functioning of a good team is versus a dysfunctional team. And it comes back to, you know, what it is that you've decided you're trying to get done as a business, and then make sure you populate the team that's going to make it happen with people that know how to work together. Because, you know, I find this story unbelievably rare. There's very few examples I have of single shingles, if you will, you know, having a good chunk of the answers and building the size of business that he did. I don't have that ability. What I got good at is making sure I understood what I wasn't good at and making sure the team I put together operated with as little ego as possible, so that there was no you know, pride of ownership as such. The right answer is what the right answer is. The good news for all of us, back to your opening comment, I think you're absolutely right. There's a lot of useless data being produced. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that will never be useful to anybody. The art is getting down to what the useful stuff is, and the good news is you get that answer right away when you start to make a change. It's not like the old days where you threw it over the fence to the tech department. They got through their priority list 6 months later to tell you that they weren't even going to try it because it's a silly idea. Why didn't you ask me in the first place? This is like real-time, you know, agile computing. I got a bit of a funny story. I opened with the one of my business partners at Lavalife was a serial dater. Like, this guy would go on 2-3 dates a day, right? He'd come back, and you know, and it's all the rage now to be talking about agile development, where, you know, of course the business people sit right beside the technology people, and you do everything in real time and get the feedback. This was back in like early 2000. Ed would go out on a date, he'd hear what the girl had to say, and our site was all about making the site, you know, safe and great for women. He'd come back, sit beside Craig Strong, who was our only programmer at the time, and they'd bang out a change and they'd get the results right away. That's what he's talking about. So it's about building a team that can work together like that, making sure that tech and business are not separated. We lost our way for a good decade where, you know, built these structures where there was project lists, and we'll get to it. That's doomed to fail. But the good news is the answers are right there. We're done?
Yep.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks for having us at your conference. Have a good rest of the day.
And what Marcus didn't tell you about why it took so long for the $800 million check to clear in the